Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. In this episode, I'm speaking with Elena Ipanova, an expert in cultural intelligence and intercultural leadership, about the essential role of cultural awareness for CTOs. We dive into what it means to see situations from new perspectives, how to bridge diverse ways of thinking within teams, and why empathy and curiosity are invaluable superpowers for tech leaders. Elena shares her playbook on navigating cultural differences, from building self-awareness to adapting communication styles and building truly inclusive teams. If you're leading a global team or just want to improve collaboration across different cultures, this conversation is for you. I'm your host, Adam Horner. As a coach for new CTOs navigating their first leadership roles, I empower tech leaders to break free from the daily grind of crisis management and build the skills to lead with confidence and purpose. Many CTOs I work with are former engineers who were promoted into leadership and were overwhelmed with constant firefighting, unsure how to communicate effectively with non-technical executives, and uncertain about their strategic impact. Drawing on over 30 years of hands-on experience, I provide practical, personalized coaching tailored to these exact challenges, helping CTOs shift from reactive problem-solving to proactive, strategic leadership. My coaching helps each CTO forge their own path for growth, allowing them to delegate confidently, align engineering with business goals, and step into their roles as trusted, respected peers at the executive table. This podcast is my way of giving back to the communities of CTOs that have supported me over the years. And between me and my guests, we cover crucial topics for CTOs, providing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you build and refine your own playbook to excel as a CTO. I've lived and worked in a number of countries and cultures, so I'm really looking forward to learning more about cultural intelligence and intercultural leadership. Elena, it's great to have you on the show.
Hi, Adam. Good to be here.
Thanks so much. I know that we connected over our shared interest in executive leadership, and particularly talking about cultural intelligence. Actually, that's something that was a kind of a new phrase to me, but something that I've been reading more up about recently. So to kick things off, could you just share a little bit about what cultural intelligence is and why you see it as an essential skill to engineering and technology leaders in general, especially CTOs?
So there are many definitions. I'm going to stick to two that I think are the most relevant and simple to grasp. So the first one, it's our ability to see the same situation from a different perspective, which might seem to be easy, but in reality, it's not. And the second one that I usually apply to, especially working with teams, is that cultural intelligence is about the ability to relate to and work together with people who think and behave differently. We can't expect people to think the same way, and things can get really hard in the process. So how do we navigate those? And cultural intelligence can definitely help in that. And as for your second question, why it is so relevant for CTOs, extremely relevant. Yes, being an expert, having all the tech skills, usually people run into assumptions that you're so good, then you have to be good with people as well. But in reality, this muscle might be not that strong. And just bringing people on board, even though technically you know all the aspects, might be very challenging. Bringing people to the same page, noticing team dynamics, asking the right questions in the right time. So this is what tech leaders need, I believe, and cultural intelligence can definitely help with that.
That's an awesome one. So your perspective there is interesting, because it doesn't necessarily need a difference of culture in the way that we grow up to be able to have to overcome seeing something from somebody else's perspective. It could be only subtly, slightly different, and yet still have some sort of barrier to overcome in terms of understanding, in terms of compassion, in terms of comprehension.
Exactly. And I think that I need to break one assumptions that people have when we talk about cultures. Usually people run into nationalities, national culture as one of the brightest aspects, but actually it's not. It's just a part of our complex identity, a part of what shapes us. And I think it's crucial to understand how we are different or similar, how culture might impact the way we behave and the way we communicate. But I would ask everyone to pay attention to the personal culture rather than thinking, oh, all Indians work this way or all Swedes work this way, because it's not.
Yeah, I think I had a sort of interaction with that very early on in my years, because I went to school to an international school in Switzerland for 6 years. So I grew up around, as you said, lots of different nationalities, you know, Turkey, Japan, Nigeria, people from the US. And the biggest surprise I had was when I left school and went back to the UK and sort of realized I don't really fit in that brilliantly in the UK either. Everybody else had been assuming, and I had been assuming, that I was British. And I kind of realized, actually, I didn't have much of an anchor to it. So I kind of had to relearn what it was to be British. You know, the pub, the pint, the pound, you know, these are the sort of the three key things I had to relearn, if you like. And I think that was my first encounter with that. So, I mean, in terms of your experience, do you find the tech leaders often overlook their own home cultures and their own assumptions about who they are?
Oh, of course they do. We all do, because we all have assumptions, and cultural intelligence is not something that gives you an immunity. I think it's important to know that it gives you tools to navigate how to navigate different situations. But very often we expect people to behave in a certain way. Let me give you an example. Let's say you are a very direct and straightforward communicator. So you just say what you mean. And certainly there are many people who appreciate that. But then we might have different preferences in terms of communication. And there are definitely people who are more, we call it high context communicators, or they put more value into sharing context first and then coming to the point. And then just for these people, you might come across as very rude or very kind of going straight to the face. And they need some more like contextual, something to build upon.
Some layers first before you get into the key points. Yeah.
And this is one of the most common clashes that I see in teams.
Right. Okay. A difference in terms of how much context people expect before. So how did you sort of first encounter cultural differences? What was it that sort of was a trigger point for you to think, okay, these differences are interesting and I need to learn more about this?
Oh, this is a good question. I was working a lot with international teams in a very big nonprofit organization. And that time I had a degree in training and methodology and in psychology and psychotherapy. So I felt that I was so equipped to work with people, to bring people on board. And I was doing good. But then working with international teams, I noticed that there are some things that we interpret in a certain way. But in reality, when you start talking to people, when you ask questions, then they open up a totally different side and they give you a perspective that things are actually not the way you thought they were. And it helped me to choose how to respond to different situations. It helped me to learn how to pause and before running automatically on the assumptions, question myself, is it fact or is it an assumption? How can I check this? So it evoked my interest to intercultural field and also pushed me to study this more in depth. And then eventually I started working with this. And I'm really enjoying that.
Do you have any specific examples of where you sort of ran into a situation you suddenly sort of realized maybe afterwards, oh, that was not good. That's something I want to be able to fix in the future.
From my personal experience, you mean?
Yeah. Because I'm just interested and curious in terms of, because it's often an event, isn't it, that drives us to do something that becomes our sort of, you know, life's meaning, our life's value. There's often one thing that sticks out in the memory. It's like, oh, that was a thing that I will always remember as the pivoting point when I knew I had to change this in myself, for example.
There is one thing from, it's rather an example from my youth years when I had a boyfriend from a different culture. And that time I was an expert in like training and education field. And I was so good in making like various interactive presentations when you are to present something, to share on specific topic, to have a framework to present it. And I remember that he was doing a presentation for his work and he was struggling and I decided to help him. And I've done it from my perspective that it should be an interaction. It should be this and that. And then he tried to explain me that, you know, things might not be the same way, but okay, let's try to do it this way. And then I'm sitting in the audience for the presentation and he presents. And that is my layout and the framework that I designed. And the feedback that he gets is totally awful. And I felt so bad. And then it hit me that in this setting, and it was not only a different culture in terms of national culture and country, but it was also the culture of the audience in the room.
In terms of what they were expecting.
Yeah. And the professional culture, the specific profession like biology. So it hit me that, Alena, you have so much to learn.
Wow. Okay. That's really memorable. So that must have been quite a pivot point in your own approach to things, even if not at the time, then perhaps later on.
Definitely. It made me more humble.
It really reminds me of a time I moved to Sweden about, what was it, five and a half years ago. And at some point, you know, my family and I, we went to a smorgasbord, you know, a buffet table. And, you know, my kids and I were grabbing bread and butter as you do. And I was getting some real side eye from some of the other people there. And it wasn't until afterwards I realized that there's a more respectful way to take the butter in Sweden. You know, people are quite particular about it. And I'd inadvertently just trodden over this one of these cardinal rules of, you know, don't dig holes in the butter. so those moments I think turn into great learning experiences and changing points. It certainly did for me as well. So in terms of turning things around then, in terms of your pivot point and changing that to work with global teams, where did you get to the point where you're sort of now beginning to work with very disparate groups or real challenging problems between cultural differences between people?
Can you rephrase your question?
In terms of, you know, the work that you do now, helping teams and people and leaders have this sort of cultural inclusivity to the way that they work. What was sort of the build up towards that for you?
I think for me, it happened very naturally. And that was my drive and my interest to try doing new things. And because I have a background in Sweden as well. So I moved here to study and I started working with mentorship programs here. And I got my foot into big companies such as Volvo, Ericsson. And that was something that brought me the realizations that in my mind, I felt like, oh, I really want to help them to solve all these like high level challenges. But what I realized that the challenges that they had were on the basic level, how you build relationships, how you develop trust, how you communicate and navigate different dynamics. And I think exactly this experience shaped my willingness to go to the field and to start addressing those challenges, even when people were not completely aware. So that was something that brought me to the point of, okay, now I'm starting working with that and shaping my professional consultancy around these topics.
And so did you start working specifically with the leaders or, as you say, working with people, you know, in teams and working together?
I started working with leaders and I did lots of job shadowing as well to understand what are the specific challenges that they're facing. And I mostly worked at first with the middle management and with teams. And then I started working with executive level C-suite as well, because then I realized that, okay, regardless how much time I spent with middle management and teams, if they don't get support from the top, nothing happens. And I see it as my mission now to address all the levels and especially to work with top levels. I do lots of executive coaching these days, and this is how I entered that field. Because for me, it's a lot about not just coaching executives, but also coaching them how to coach their team for better sustainability.
Cool. Okay. And in terms of the sort of the common pitfalls and common problems that you see at that executive level, but also at that middle management level, what are sort of the repeated challenges, roadblocks that you identify?
Oh, there are many. Where to start from?
Well, I guess the key things would be, what would be the first or most obvious signs that there's something that needs fixing that it falls within your sphere of influence?
So the first one is the mindset. And I think it's crucial because then you can have as many trainings, different learning possibilities. But if you don't approach it with the right mindset, it's not going to do the job. So I see lots of leaders applying old mindset to new things. So they fail in thinking differently. They fail in taking in new perspective, or they find it challenging when they try and then they make a step back. So I think this is the first.
Reverting to previous behavior kind of situation. Yeah.
And then another aspect that I'm noticing is I work a lot with engineers And I noticed the tendency and the passion to put everything into boxes. And especially when it comes to soft skills and cultural intelligence is something that sounds very fluffy. Like, what is it? How do we measure that? Where can we put that? So they get fascinated with cultural differences, especially if they work internationally or they manage international multicultural team. And they, okay, tell me how to work with Indians. Tell me how to work with Germans. So they try to attribute specific traits to working with people, how to like simplify it for themselves. And here I come challenging their perception that, okay, we can learn how culture operates as a system. What is accepted here, what is normal here, but it doesn't mean that it corresponds to people's personal preferences. Like, I grew up in a very hierarchical culture, but personally, I value like egalitarian flat structure where I'm on the same like level with the rest of the team. So there's a huge difference here that people fail to understand.
Cool. So it's getting head around the fact that there may well be differences between your organization and yourself. And this is even before we've got to the point of having different offices within there that each have their own sort of subcultures within those offices, whether they're in different countries or just in different cities.
Exactly. And the ultimate question here is like, how big is the gap between my normal and what is accepted here on the organizational level? And then you meet people you interact with every day, you work together. And then another question, how big is the gap between my normal and your normal? So if we can locate that, we can strategically bridge that and create more synergy rather than running on assumptions that, oh, you are so like rude or you are not respectful or anything of this kind.
Cool. And what would you say are the biggest symptoms that you look at? So if you're looking at an organization who's got in touch with you, what would be the symptoms you'd look at? You go, okay, yes, they do need my help versus, oh, no, you guys are fine. What are the obvious differences?
Obvious differences, there are plenty actually on different levels. As I see, for example, in some teams, they say, oh, we have a high level of agreement. So we like everyone, like consensus, for example, in Sweden is a big thing. And everyone agrees, but then I also challenge their perspective. Okay, is it like everyone agrees or people don't dare to voice their opinion? So there are certain signs or certain symptoms that show that, for example, there is no psychological safety because people don't contribute. Why don't they contribute with their ideas? Management can say we are taking decisions because we don't get enough contribution. And when we ask, people don't share. So the question is why? So there's a one-sided communication as a symptom, but what's the root cause of this problem?
Right, because one-sided communication does not match with the consensus approach that everybody believes that there should be in that scenario.
Yes.
Cool. Okay, so in general then, to try and generalize, it would be discrepancies between the stated culture and the experienced culture would be the key thing.
Yeah, yeah. Or if you want to look at the company's values, and the best check-in here, whatever we see as a company value, you check any job announcement and or website, and then you talk to people how much it corresponds to their everyday experiences. So you might find lots of interesting insights exactly directing you to their problems that might exist there.
Cool. Okay. So again, it comes down to that experience of people within the teams as being sort of the red flag for you in terms of, yep, there's help that's needed here. Cool. Let's move into the actual playbook. Because from my perspective, I've sort of run by two very simple principles when it comes to this. And I'm hopefully you're going to expand on that and show me a better way. But for me, I've always gone with the idea of being curious rather than guessing as sort of as one of the first steps. And then the other thing is to generally assume that people have good intentions. And so therefore, if there's a difference between what people say and do, or between things that the people are trying to do correctly or want to do it correctly, but there's something else that's the problem, I tend to try and so assume good intentions and being curious. So I sort of two simplistic approaches, but you've got a sort of a more built up playbook and framework here. So let's run through that, shall we? So I think the first step in there, which you mentioned at the beginning, actually, which is self-awareness. So how do we become more self-aware, and how can we assess whether or not we are self-aware or at least culturally aware within our business?
It's a brilliant question. And actually, there is the research also showing that the majority of people are thinking that they are self-aware, but only 15% are self-aware in reality.
That's a really low number.
Yes. So I think it should be like, I really love your simplistic methods with curiosity and assuming that it's positive intention. I think it serves well. It already opens up. And just with self-awareness, I think it's just about the understanding that how can I lead others better, or how can I build healthy, thriving relationships with others if I don't have a capability to lead myself, or if I don't know myself well. So self-work or self-leadership is the starting point. And the best way to locate where you are in this journey is to ask for feedback. And if you allow, I can give a specific exercise for that, that I'm using in my practice. So it's tested on thousands of engineers, and it works. It's very simple. Many of you might know the Johari window technique, where you have like open area, you have something that you know about yourself and others know. It's your open area, and then something that you know about yourself, but others don't know. And then it has the blind area where people know something about you, but you are not aware of that. And there is unknown area. So the best way here is maybe to take these social circles that you have, like different social circles. We have colleagues at work, we have friends, we have family, and write for yourself how you think they see you. And then ask them to describe you. What kind of teammate you are, what kind of leader you are. So any context that is intellectually and personally interesting to you, like what kind of side of yourself you want to explore more, and then compare that feedback and see what kind of insights you can get out of it. Maybe you will realize that, oh, there are certain things that I'm so proud of, but people just don't know about them. So how can I bring it forward? Or maybe people see some good stuff in you, but you're just so ignorant to that. You don't know that you have it. Then you have the ability to bring it to the open area and basically become the best version of yourself. But there is also bitter feedback, because you also ask them, what do you think is holding me back? Which areas I can improve? And then you also get some golden nuggets there about the things that you might not be aware of. So this exercise is very helpful as the first step, definitely.
And it sounds very simple. Describe yourself and ask others to describe you. And then you sort of split it into two there. So what do you think are all the positive attributes, but also what do you think are the things where you could improve?
Yeah, exactly.
Very simple, very powerful. And then so when it comes from you know, the self-awareness, the self-understanding, and then doing this self-assessment, which involves asking others, which is very, very simple and straightforward. So how do we get into to the next stage of understanding the cultural differences between ourselves and others?
There are different methods here as well. And I would say on the stage of self-awareness, there is also one other tool that I use, which is called Global DISC. It's not quite a regular DISC. It gives you much more in terms of specifically cultural components. So it gives you more aspects to analyze and to look into from the cultural perspective and personality type perspective. So it's not about putting people into boxes, but it's about opening up to see how culture might condition you and what kind of behavioral communication tendencies you have depending on different contexts. And it just allows you to learn more about your autopilot reactions and analyze if it's something that serves you well at work, for example, or if it's something that holds you back and creates rather negative impact. And from this, we can also put people on the map, I would say. So there is an exercise which I call the team culture map. So when you have a bunch of different people, and they all run through the Global DISC assessment, so we can see all people on different scales, where they are in terms of their preferences, the way they prefer to communicate, the way they prefer to be led, or they are leading others. the way they give feedback, the way they react in or behave in conflict situation. So it opens up for the conversation and it's not for the judgment. So it's just to show that this is where we are as a team, how we want it to be. Where are the biggest gaps? How can we bridge them strategically? So when you give people this transparency, it creates more psychological safety, more openness in discussing different strategies. How do we actually create synergy?
You've got that extra context within the team then.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Cool. I'm just going to scoot back a little bit, and just because there may be some people who are not familiar with DISC. So DISC is a personality type test, isn't it? And it covers sort of four, I'm going to go from memory here, dominance, influence, steadiness, and what was the last one?
It was in Global DISC, it's a little bit like different. It's direction, inspiration, it's service, and oh my God, what was C for?
Okay, so the Global DISC is slightly different from the standard one then.
It is, it is. It has same color codes and sort of a similar structure, but it gives you reflection on different cultures as well. The how you show how cultural background tendencies might influence your preferences in communication, in behavior.
Okay. And so you go through a process of running through that test. I presume there's an online location you can go and run that test then. And then with the results, you sort of, do you cluster them, or do you just do a comparison to see who's more similar than the others within a team?
You can do it individually, first of all. And individually, you just look through your personal preferences and you reflect on, okay, how true I feel it is. For me, what's the challenges that I'm experiencing? What are the strengths and weaknesses that I have? And then when you have, you can also compare it with the country. For example, when an executive comes from Japan to Sweden, so we can compare his personal preferences with the average in Sweden. Also keeping in mind that it's just the average. It doesn't mean that all Swedes are going to be this way, but it helps us to locate potential gaps and prepare for that. And then when you place people and you have this team culture map, then you have them all on different scales. For example, we take simple with communication, two extreme sides, direct communication, I go straightforward, I say what I mean, and indirect communication, that it's subtle, context first, and it's very indirect. I'm very concerned about your feelings. If it's something sensitive, I don't want to hurt you. And we can have people on different sides in the team. And then imagine how it might impact team dynamics when it's a stressful situation, when you need to deliver, when this deadline approaching, when someone can't complete a part and don't dare to ask for help. So this person might be on the high context side. And then on direct side, we wonder, like, what's going on? Why they just didn't tell me that it didn't work? I could help to fix that. So there's lots of friction. And if you're aware of that, and if you discuss it prior to like any project work, then it goes very smooth.
So it's fundamentally about the knowledge and awareness, reducing the barriers to be able to smoothly communicate. Yeah.
Bridging the gaps.
And that's generally where you build your understanding from, is just analyzing yourself first and then understanding how you fit into the average for your location, team, wherever. But then also having a dialogue with the other members in your team, the people you work most closely with, to compare and in some cases contrast those scores from the Global DISC assessment. Cool. We can put a link to the Global DISC assessment into the show notes so that people can go and click on that and do that afterwards.
You have to, it's not accessible like online free. So it has to be done through the practitioners.
Okay, right.
But I'm the right person to contact.
Get a consultant like yourself to go through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great. We can get to that at the end as well then. Brilliant. Cool. Okay. So from there then, you sort of step three in your playbook is to then sort of build relationships. Does that start literally just from that communication, the understanding of where you sit on that Global DISC assessment?
It can be a good start. So it's just one of the tools that I find very helpful in my work and in my practice. And I think generally what you mentioned about curiosity and just being genuinely curious about others and building relationships. Because here we also have, for example, my experience in Swedish culture is that people are very friendly, but they are focused on tasks in their day-to-day work. So it might be not that easy to build relationships, which are something more than just, you know, colleagues and knowing what you are up to in your project, but just
so quite transactional.
Yeah. But just building a better understanding. And here I see lots of Indians, Chinese, Spanish working in Sweden who are struggling with that. And that I would like to know people better. I would like to build relationships. So these are also maybe some subtle differences, but they might impact the way we work together. So building relationships starts from having conversations. And the most challenging might be like, how do you integrate that into work process? Because usually, like in Sweden, we have fika, where you socialize, you take coffee, and this is the space for socializing and connecting with others. But in some other work cultures, it might not be the case. So here is the question, how do we integrate that?
Right, the so-called water cooler moments. When is the natural time to have those non-work, non-transactional, natural conversations?
Yeah. Global Disc is one of the ways, but it's not about the tool. It's just what you mentioned, when it opens up the discussion, when people see that, oh, I'm here and you're here on the scale. Oh, look, how big is the gap? What does it mean to you? And what does it mean to me? So how are we going to work together? It opens up. But then there are also other aspects how you can build relationships or encourage people as a leader, as a CTO, to build relationships. I have one example from the company I collaborated with. So they integrated this very informal check-ins in their virtual meetings because they were like having virtual meetings and it was during COVID and they're still using this method as well. So they delegated each team member. So they were taking turns and they were supposed to find an interesting question for the whole team to answer. And there, it's very simple, but there they got so many different perspectives because people had different questions from like whatever like sort of coffee you would like to get, like you enjoy the most and why, to what's the most like exciting destination or where have you been or what's the most crazy thing that you've done in your life. And they would spend just 5 minutes in their stand-up meeting in the morning to answer those questions. And people had a feeling that actually I learned something about my colleagues, or actually we have a similar hobby or anything that can connect us, or something that I would like to learn diving. And you're a diving instructor. I didn't know about that. Tell me more. So these type of initiatives are very easy to integrate and they don't feel like something on the top of everything. They feel like natural.
Because it's kind of delegated down to the individuals and it becomes
exactly
baked into the existing meetings you have as well. I mean, the stand-ups is something that very commonly happens in engineering teams and group work teams. And so therefore, it sounds like a very straightforward thing to add and doesn't need to take too much time from what you're saying. But it's a deliberate approach of creating a non-transactional casual relationship conversation. Yeah, cool. And in terms of communication styles, I mean, what you just mentioned there is sort of quite, I wouldn't call it forceful, but it's certainly a set way of doing it. What I've often noticed is that when it comes down to communication styles, a lot of CTOs I work with have one predominant communication style that they use and approach most of their communication with. So one of the steps I've noticed that you have is to be more adaptive. So how is it that we can get more adaptive? What's the first stage to getting to more adaptive communication style?
It comes with practice. So I think, first of all, you have to be aware how you come across to others. And then we do mix communication styles because usually when I run these polls for people in my training sessions, when I ask them to identify their dominant communication style, they see that there is a huge variety. And then I say, okay, but is it the same in a conflict situation? And usually it's different. If they were direct in their like regular communication, in conflict situation, they might kind of fade away and they can suddenly go to the indirect communication style. So just being aware of that is definitely the first step. And then noticing and observing others, what are their tendencies in communication, and what are some of the things that they struggle with? And I have a very good example that is kind of repetitive example that I see in my executive coaching practice, what people struggle with, especially while they are on the meetings and they have like round with where every team member is supposed to share what they are up to, share the updates and plan for the like next iteration or whatever they do. So the most common thing or frustration that they experience is with some team members who, as they say, take too much space to explain things and still they don't get to the point. And they say that it influences the dynamic in the team, that people get tired. You can see it by their faces, and the one who's presenting feels discouraged and they don't know what to do about that. So they're trying to stick to the agenda, but it doesn't work. It's a repetitive thing. And then one of the methods that I teach them, like a very simple one, how you can adapt and direct. Obviously, you see that the person has a rather indirect communication style given too much context. So we need to narrow it down, and we want to be inclusive and polite and respectful. So asking like, what's one most important thing that you want all of us to know? Now, this one question can help tremendously to this person who is taking too much space to really start thinking in one point. What is that? And communicate it accordingly. And then you can, as a manager, as a CTO, you can coach your team members. And then they understand that, okay, it works. Maybe then I learn how to ask this question myself before the meeting, so that I'm not all over the place, but I'm very structured. And it is only one example, how you adapt and how you help others navigate better.
So it's interesting. So what you're saying there is that most of us actually probably have a range of communication styles we already use. So it's not necessarily a case of learning a whole new toolbox of tricks. More, it's about getting more aware of when we use each one, analyzing whether we're actually using it in the right way or not, as some fairly simple, straightforward questions of ourselves. If I used a different approach in that scenario, would it be an improvement?
Yes.
Is that fair summary?
As simple as that.
Simple is rarely easy, but I think that's something that's probably news to a lot of people, because I think a lot of engineers, especially senior engineers, think that they've got a limited range of communication experiences. But what you've just literally given them permission to do is to realize that they've actually got more experience than they think. It's just about how and when they apply it that's the bit where they need to, and as you say, practice.
Yes, yes.
Rather than learn a lot of new things.
And they need to understand in which context it serves them well, because we can go on autopilot in different situations. And the question is, does it serve us well? Do we need to shift a little bit? Do we need to change the direction so that it actually works and creates the outcome that we want to create?
So retraining our instincts as to when is the right time to use each communication style.
Yes. And unlearning as well. Because this is the, like, one of the things actually that when you asked about the roadblocks, I think it is also one of them, our like inability to unlearn. So we know something for sure. We experienced that many times and we are stuck in this. It just works this way. But actually, like, we need to be able to unlearn that and revisit it from a different angle. And then we might see whole new ways how to do the same thing, maybe smarter.
Yeah. Unlearning is a hard thing because it's often indicative of an ingrained habit. And when we're under pressure, we fall back onto habits, as we know. So I guess what you're saying is to begin to form new habits that break the old ones. And that's sort of the unlearning aspect of it.
Yeah, it's a good formulation.
It's a tough one to do, isn't it? When you know you're doing something that's not right, and yet how do you figure out how to do it right in the moment? It's always a tough one. And I guess that goes with that then is the sort of continuous approach to getting better, improving, and I guess getting feedback on how we're doing as well. What's your sort of best trick for embedding this idea of having, you know, culturally aware communication in the teams?
You have to be a role model. Like, if you are on a position You have to be. As I talk a lot about vulnerability and just whatever you do, the team will feel that, okay, we are permitted to do that too. And making more culturally like, or creating more culturally sensitive and culturally aware team, you have to work on yourself first, because you obviously can't do it in the way that, oh, I read a book. Now we are going to work by the book. See, there's lots of wisdom here. I want everyone in the team to read this book. We are going to do things like here. It's like a very successful case. And the horrible news is that there are people doing that still, trying to create awareness, trying to change something. And definitely, in my opinion, this is like the wrong way to do it, because you have to be an example. If you are behaving inclusively, let's say also like in the Swedish environment, but also in a like Spanish speaking environment where there are multicultural teams, where the language identity is very strong, there are lots of cases of exclusion that are happening from the senior perspective. And people are sharing that, you know, we are sitting at the board, we are having an event or we are having a meeting, and I do not understand what my colleagues are talking about. They speak Spanish and the official language in the company is English. And then I have a senior sitting right by my side and he continues conversation in Spanish, even though I'm here and obviously I'm like, I speak limited like language, but, and then with this behavior, the senior leader gives permission to the rest of the team that, oh, it's okay to speak Spanish, fine. So we have to filter that our own behavior, whatever we do or we don't do, contributes to something. So what does it contribute to? To more cultural awareness, to more inclusion, or to exclusion? So asking yourself this question and asking for feedback as well can help a lot to find the way to navigate through that and through your work on yourself, showing your vulnerability as well, sharing your mistakes, admitting your mistakes. You create more open environment, more curiosity in your team as well.
So it's very much the same approach as you take for learning anything else new. If you want your team to do something, be the role model, be the embodiment of it yourself, and others will copy you. Even when I find it, even when it's sort of subliminal or not even obvious what somebody else is doing or why they're doing it, people tend to copy. And even if they don't know the theory and the background, they copy it and the behavior improves all around with less effort, I would say, in many cases. Do you find the same thing with cultural awareness and the identity, the communication identity as well?
Yeah, I do find that. And then I think it depends a lot on the also quality of questions and quality of topics discussed in teams in general, besides the like the work issues or even in relation to the work issues, like, oh, how would you approach this project or how would you do that from your perspective or from your previous experience? Like, what did you learn about this or that? And generally, like being curious, like if I have a team with 7 different nationalities, I want to know more about their culture. Generally, I know that not all people want to know, but even like when you start learning different things, you get more excited about it. And if you are a leader and you are curious and your curiosity can be sensed, you're signaling that, then people will also be curious to actually share and exchange experience, knowledge, ideas, life experiences.
And that's exactly how we can make the most of our diverse team rather than having a diverse team and not actually leveraging the difference and benefiting from it.
Exactly. Exactly. Diversity is just a potential. So it's not like we brought people and they are so different and now we expect them to deliver a great project. So we have to do the groundwork. We have to bring them to the same page to create synergy.
Cool. Excellent. So to summarize then, so step one was self-awareness and potentially going through an assessment approach to help that awareness to understand how we are, you know, identified for ourselves. And the simple version is to go and ask for feedback from other people. How do we see ourselves? How do they see us? And looking at the differences between those two. We had the understanding of the cultural differences. So basically being able to identify the differences in style, communication, approach, assumptions, which is a very big one, I think, and the differences and the similarities as well between different teams, groups, nationalities, and other cultural boundaries within our teams. To use that knowledge then to build on the relationships as the third step in your playbook, to literally create more of a common understanding, a common camaraderie between people through those relationships, and then adapting communication style to different situations, to different perspectives, and to the ways in which some other people like to receive communication as well as the way we like to give it.
That's a perfect summary.
Finally, continuous learning and continuous feedback is at the end of almost all good playbooks, isn't it? Is where we continue to build on that, improve further, and spread the influence more widely.
Yeah, and definitely cultural intelligence is not about just learning about different cultures, because we are going to experience misunderstandings. We are going to experience conflicts. We can't avoid those things, but the quality of our navigation can be different. So we can choose how to respond instead of reacting on autopilot.
Absolutely. That's a really good point as well. So for anybody who would like to be able to get in touch with you, to learn more, to ask you to come and help them work with them, for example, how do people get in touch with you, Elena?
LinkedIn is one of the best ways. I'm active there and responsive. And I think it also gives a chance to people to see what I am up to, if I'm actually the right person to talk to. So feel free to connect with me in LinkedIn and scroll through my feed as well.
Excellent. Thanks so much. Elena, it's been wonderful to talk to you. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you for this opportunity, Adam. It's been a pleasure.
Wonderful. And for all of our listeners, continue to lead with impact. See you on the next episode. Thanks very much. Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.